Today is Wednesday, the 18th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban offers general amnesty and vows to protect women's rights.
How this thing will work out in the days to come, we don't know, and that is why there is skepticism.
Plus, while still recovering from an earthquake, Haiti is hit by a powerful storm.
The situation last night could not be any more complicated for the earthquake survival. We had like hundreds of people screaming for help. And the thing is, nobody came to help them.
We'll have these stories and more next. At a news conference in Kabul, a Taliban spokesperson vowed to respect women's rights within Islamic law and form an inclusive Islamic government. The Taliban also announced on Tuesday a general amnesty for all, including government officials, and urged them to return to work. VOA's Ayaz Gul reports on the skepticism some have on the Taliban's pledge.
This is a significant step on part of the Taliban, and skepticism is obviously there because they have, as of today, they have pardoned their real enemies that were considered real enemies of the Taliban, warlords. They have announced amnesty for government officials, security forces. How this thing will work out in the days to come, we don't know, and that is why there is skepticism and there are worries whether the Taliban will stick to their commitments. But this amnesty is a big step. There are two notorious warlords, Abdul Rashid Dostum and Atta Muhammad, who were very influential in northern Afghanistan. They fled Afghanistan during the recent fighting into Uzbekistan. But now we are hearing reports that Taliban are encouraging them to come back to their country and that the amnesty is applicable to those warlords. And then there are notorious former Afghan government commanders and police commanders who have been told to live a comfortable life, that Taliban will not touch them. In fact, Taliban officials have gone into the homes of some of these people who were worried about their safety and personally told them, conveyed to them that, you know, you can live comfortably and Taliban will provide security for them. So these are steps that we are seeing, but how will they translate really into a stable policy? It is seen and it is premature, I think, to guess anything at this stage.
VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad, Pakistan. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Tuesday that Afghanistan's leadership was responsible for the rapid collapse of the Afghan military, but noted the alliance should learn lessons on how it conducts military training. The Pentagon says the U.S. military is communicating with the Taliban while wrapping up U.S. air evacuations of Americans and Afghan allies at the international airport in Kabul. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb shares those details.
The U.S. military commanders on the ground at the airport were communicating with the commanders, the Taliban commanders on the ground outside the airport. When we tried to get more information about whether or not this was a deconfliction method, he would not elaborate. He just simply said that I'll let the results speak for themselves. And he pointed out that there had not been any hostile interactions.
Speaking of the airport, what is the current situation there in terms of operational status and getting people out of the country?
Well, we have been told that at least 9 C-17 military transport planes arrived with equipment and 1,000 additional troops late Monday. And that brings us to about 4,000 U.S. troops by the end of today, officials would have told me. When it comes to the evacuations, they say that there's been at least 7 C-17s that took off, 800 civilian evacuees, 165 of them Americans. That's a total over the last couple of days of about 1,400 or 1,500 evacuees that have left Afghanistan. We also heard some devastating news that just came out from the Air Force. They have released that human remains were found on a C-17 after it landed in Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. We all were looking at this horrific footage on Monday of these Afghan civilians swarming the airport tarmac, trying to get on these military planes. We saw video that looked like one or two, maybe even more people who had fallen off the aircraft as it took off. And now we're learning that when that C-17 landed in Qatar, They looked on the plane and they found human remains at a wheel well of that plane. The implication, we don't know the further details because they did not give us specifics. They say that an investigation is underway, and they said that they are going to wait until that is finished before they can provide further information. But I have been told by a U.S. official, based on the condition of anonymity, that potentially multiple individuals climbed into more than one of the wheel wells.
Carla, that is absolutely devastating news. One last question. I understand that General McKenzie, the commander of the U.S. Central Command, visited Kabul on Tuesday.
U.S. Central Command said that he had an opportunity to evaluate the situation on the ground, and he saw how the evacuation was finally appeared to be going smoothly at this point. The goal, U.S. officials say, is they would like to ramp up the evacuations so that one plane can leave and evacuate with Afghan citizens and Americans every hour. If they could get to that pace, that would be between 5,000 and 9,000 civilians being evacuated every single day. They are not there yet, but they were hoping to be at that pace by Wednesday.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. U.S. President Joe Biden returned to the White House Tuesday evening, facing increasing criticism over how his administration handled the withdrawal of American forces and the Taliban's rapid road to the control of the country. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara joins us now with the latest.
Well, certainly right now, it's all about damage control. And the president's early return from the presidential retreat that he was on in Camp David. So a couple of messages that came out of the White House, including from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who said that, yes, those scenes that we are seeing of Afghans climbing up American jets, people falling off the planes, and, you know, hundreds of Afghans being stuffed into a plane, those scenes that we see were chaotic and heartbreaking. But the National Security Advisor said that President Biden also had to think about the human cost of the alternative path as well, which was to stay in the middle of what the National Security Advisor called a civil war in Afghanistan, a country where there is little U.S. interest. So he's basically saying it's not within America's interest. He essentially said when you conclude 20 years of military action in a civil war in another country, with the impacts of all those 20 years of decisions that have piled up, of course, not all of them made by President Biden, but previous presidents we have behind him, you have to make a lot of hard calls, and not all of those will be clean and a good outcome. Right now, the focus of the administration is just on evacuation, prioritizing American citizens, embassy employees and families, local embassy staff, also this special category called the special immigrant visa holders.
Patsy, the president did briefly return to the White House on Monday to address the nation. And during his remarks, he said that the buck stops with him. Has the administration clarified to what level of responsibility he or the administration is taking?
Well, we did ask National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan exactly that question during the briefing today, because even though President Biden said that the buck stops with him, he also blamed other parties, in particular President Ashraf Ghani, who fled the country. He blamed the Afghan military, who essentially did not take up a fight, as well as blaming the previous administration, President Trump, who set up the initial May 1st withdrawal. But when we asked National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, what does it mean the buck stops with the president? He says that he is taking responsibility. President Biden is taking responsibility for every decision the United States government took with respect to Afghanistan. And National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan also said that he's taking responsibility, as well as his colleagues, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all of the other people, all of the other senior administration official, for all the decisions, the good ones and the ones that don't produce the intended outcomes.
Patsy Wiedekuswara reports for VOA from the White House. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. UN agencies are expressing grave concern about the welfare of Afghanistan's civilian population, especially women and children, as Taliban insurgents tighten their control over the country. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Afghanistan for many years has been one of the worst places on earth to be a child. UN agencies report every day the flaring conflict in Afghanistan is taking a greater toll on the lives and well-being of the country's women and children. A recent UN report finds more than 550 children have been killed and an estimated 1,400 maimed this year. This is the highest number of child casualties in the first 6 months of any year since the UN began keeping records in 2009 in Afghanistan. UN Children's Fund Chief of Field Operations and Emergency Mustafa Ben Masood says in the past few weeks, conditions for children have worsened. Speaking on a video link from the capital, Kabul, he says the health and nutritional status of children are of major concern.
As we speak, our prediction for 2021 are one child out of two will be severely malnourished. There are 18 million Afghan that are in need of humanitarian assistance. Half of them are children.
Ben Masood adds UNICEF is becoming increasingly concerned about the rise in grave violations, especially the recruitment of children by armed groups. UNICEF has 13 field offices across the country. They have remained open throughout the many months of fierce conflict. Over the past 2 weeks, Ben Masood has been in the major cities of Kandahar, Herat, and now Kabul, and has seen the direct impact of the fighting on the Afghan people. The UNICEF official says he and colleagues have been in direct contact with the Taliban. He says they have met with military commanders and with newly appointed Taliban NGO commissioners. He says UNICEF has discussed the importance of retaining its female national and international staff and has pressed them on the issue of girls' education.
The stand of the Taliban is more or less the same. But we've seen small differences, especially in terms of girls' education, especially for the female Afghan colleagues. Here again, we've had measured answers from them. But let's say that we are cautiously optimistic on moving forward.
UNICEF is calling for immediate and unhindered access to the hard-to-reach areas to deliver much-needed support to the Afghan population. Officials say it is particularly critical to reach women and children who are paying the heaviest price in this violent, turbulent society. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
What are some of the larger impacts of the situation that's currently unfolding in Afghanistan? Well, VOA Georgian Service Yamashvili discusses that and more with the Eurasia Group's president, Ian Bremmer.
The legacy of the past 20 years will be a United States that is much, much, much more reluctant to engage in military-led nation-building exercises anywhere around the world. That is probably by far the most significant legacy of the last 20 years. By the way, the legacy will also be tens of thousands, maybe if we're lucky, hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians who had an opportunity to live a completely different life. And many of whom are now outside of Afghanistan, some in the United States, I think some 70,000 in the United States. People still want to come to the U.S. It's still a land of opportunity if you can get here.
What about the credibility with the allies? What about the credibility with the partners?
I think that the way that we left is damaging that. I think that 4 years of Trump, America first, NATO is obsolete. No, it's not obsolete, but it's transactional. And why aren't you guys doing anything? And then Biden comes in and says America's back, and the allies believe him because they've known Biden for a long time, but they don't appreciate how much the United States has changed, how much his political constraints have changed. And suddenly, the United States is making all these decisions by themselves. And I think that that does really hurt. I think that that will leave a lasting blow to the durability and the strength of U.S. alliances around the world.
And how are the adversaries taking, if they are taking, first of all, advantage of the situation?
All the adversaries are, they're certainly having a few days of we told you so, America's in decline, look, you can't trust these guys, they're no good. And that's it's unfortunate, but the adversaries focus on American power. They're not focused on American commitments, and they all understand that American power is not diminished around the world in this environment. In fact, compared to American allies, U.S. power has probably grown asymmetrically in the last couple of years, both technologically, militarily, and economically. And again, our adversaries like Russia and China and Iran are very directly aware of that. They may not want to admit it publicly, but they understand the situation.
Ian Bremmer is the president of the Eurasia Group, and he was speaking with VOA Georgian service reporter Yah Mermishvili. With the Taliban's swift takeover of Afghanistan, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari this week warned that the war on terror is not over, but is shifting to Africa. Writing in the Financial Times newspaper, Buhari said Africa needs more than U.S. military assistance to defeat terrorism. It needs investment. Timothy Ibizu takes it from here.
The Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, described the rising threat of terrorist groups in Africa, including Boko Haram in Nigeria and the Sahel region, to Al-Shabaab in Somalia and the rising insurgency in Mozambique. But Buhari lamented that Western allies, quote, bruised by their Middle East and Afghan experiences, end quote, were not prioritizing Africa. The president's spokespeople could not be immediately reached for comment, but Beacon security expert Kabir Adamu agrees with the president's opinion.
It is very likely that the developments in Afghanistan could definitely spur terrorist groups within Africa to also, it would embolden them. It would make them look at the bigger picture, which is the fact that resilience and a continuation of their efforts could lead to victory.
But while Buhari praised U.S. airstrikes in July against Al-Shabaab in Somalia, he emphasized that U.S. military forces on the ground in Africa is not what is needed. He said what Africa needs most is U.S. investment in infrastructure to help provide jobs and economic opportunities for the rapidly growing population. The Nigerian president said that Africa's population has nearly doubled since 2001, the start of the U.S.-led war on terror. And he conceded that Nigeria's own homegrown terror group, Boko Haram, was first agitated by lack of opportunities. Buhari also noted the recent attacks in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado region, centered around a rich natural gas project that provided few jobs for locals. But founder of the Global Sentinel Security magazine, Senator Irebu, says that Africa's terrorist groups are not driven by economics alone.
You know, there's a subtle competition among these jihadist groups that do each other. Since Taliban have recorded these sources, other groups like the Al-Qaeda, the ISIS, may try to also show their own hands.
In his opinion piece, Buhari wrote, "If Afghanistan taught us a lesson, it was that although sheer force can blunt terror, removal of that force can cause the threat to return." Nigeria has been fighting Boko Haram since 2009, with conflicts spilling into neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. More than 30,000 people are estimated to have been killed and millions displaced in the conflict. African nations have been working together more to fight insurgents, from the G5 Sahel to the Southern African Development Community's troops sent for the first time in July to Mozambique. But ultimately, wrote Buhari, Africans need not swords but plowshares to defeat terror. The boots they need on ground, he said, are those of constructors, not the military. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This is Science in a Minute.
Just as the Earth's atmosphere and magnetic field protects us from harmful radiation, our entire solar system is also protected from interstellar radiation by the heliosphere, a huge bubble that's inflated by the sun's magnetic field and energy from the solar wind. The region of the heliosphere where both the solar and interstellar winds meet and push against each other is called the heliopause. Scientists have theorized and built models of the heliopause, but the U.S. Department of Energy's Los Alamos National Laboratory say they have recently created the first three-dimensional map of this boundary region that marks the edge of the solar system. To create the map, the Los Alamos scientists used data from NASA's Interstellar Boundary Explorer, or IBEX, satellite that was gathered over a complete solar cycle from 2009 to 2019. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Days after a devastating earthquake hit Haiti, Grace, which was a tropical depression at the time but reclassified as a tropical storm as it moved away, brought heavy rains and strong winds to the country. Joining us from Mackay is reporter Jean Handy Tiebert with an update on how the country is dealing with multiple disasters.
The situation last night could not be any more complicated for the earthquake survival. The biggest tent camp right now in Lekai is on a football field called L'Inde de Gabion, right in the middle of the city. That's where everybody who's lost their houses, who's lost everything, that's where they stay for 2 and 3 nights. And then last night, Tropical Storm Grace hit the southern part of Haiti, Lekai. And then the rain started around 9 p.m. For those people who were living on the tent. Not even real tent. They were living under some tarpaulin, some plastic top that they found or somebody gave them, or anything they could put on top of their head, they put it. Then what happened is last night when the rain came with wind and a lot of water was pouring on them, the situation was really crazy. We had like hundreds of people screaming for help. And the thing is, nobody came to help them. At that tent camp, there were no government representatives, there were no police officers to secure them, no one, no civil protection, no one to help them.
What's the status of the recovery efforts by the government to find those who are still missing after the quake?
They decided that anyone missing is presumed dead. Anyone missing is presumed dead. I mean, there's no sign of life in the rubble. They start a second operation called demolishing. They are demolishing the houses to find dead bodies. Since yesterday, before the rain started, the army, the Haitian army and the civil protection in Haiti, they were working together, pulling out with dead bodies out of the rubble. That's why the death toll went high yesterday. And then we had the same thing again. We had the same thing again today. The death toll is going higher and higher.
You mentioned when we last spoke that the centralized aid is being flown into Port-au-Prince, but then needs to be transported to the areas that need it, like Lekai. But the roads in some places are damaged. There's questions about whether or not the gangs that are throughout Haiti will allow the transports through. What can you tell us about how aid is being distributed?
This morning, there's a report came out and said that the government has reached an agreement with the gangs to let pass humanitarian convoy through the town of Marquisan. For the aid, you know, the big machinery and aid coming from Port-au-Prince, there might be a peace treaty between the government and the gangs to let people pass through Marquisan so they can get in. And as for the small airport, the airstrip, helicopters, U.S. helicopters, and some other planes, small planes, are still flying people and supplies in. But, you know, the airport is small and the weather is not too good, so there is not a lot of flights, but we still have some flights coming in from Port-au-Prince.
Jean Handy Tiebert was speaking to me from Lekai, Haiti. And finally, thanks to carbon emissions, our oceans are turning to acid. It's dissolving the shells of oysters and attacking global shorelines, damaging ecosystems that suck more carbon dioxide from the waters than all the world's vehicles spew into the air. In this first report of the series Coast versus Climate, VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias explores the evil twin of climate change and how to remedy it.
Inside a mesh bag on Virginia's eastern shore is a gurgling answer to climate change. Scientists submerged oysters in a bed of seagrass, an experiment to see if underwater plants, which naturally absorb carbon dioxide, can protect them. You see, oceans are turning warmer and more acidic, thanks to humans burning fossil fuels. And this is hurting not just oysters, but the bountiful ecosystems around them. Michael Oppenheimer is a review editor at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Acidification occurs because the carbon dioxide we're adding to the atmosphere dissolves partly in the ocean and forms a weak acid. Any shell-forming creature has a more difficult job forming its shell in an ocean that's more acidic.
At stake is the destructive impact on marine life and the delicate food chains that sustain the world's fisheries. Take creatures called theropods. These tiny sea snails populate all the world's oceans and are a precious food for salmon and many important fish. But in acidic ocean waters, their shells dissolve. Scientists are studying ocean acidification, often called climate change's evil twin. At the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, Professor Emily Rivest runs experiments on oysters.
When we have that combination of warming and acidification, we see the most dramatic negative effects on the larvae. So they don't form their shell properly, and they don't eat as well.
The experiments help aquaculture in the Chesapeake Bay. The massive estuary suffers from coastal acidification, caused in part by heavy rains and fertilizer runoff. Michael Congrove owns a commercial oyster hatchery.
Where it becomes really tricky is when we have periods of poor water quality that we're not able to solve with our filtration solutions, and that can really put a dent in our production.
If these steps fail, oyster farmers like Brandon Eanes are at risk. He buys seed from hatcheries to sell for wholesale distribution.
You put them in these tanks and they grow.
Yes, ma'am. They put them in these tanks until they grow, until they're about half an inch. Something big enough that we can put in this bag.
Eanes is skeptical of human-made climate change, but he concedes that something in the past 10 years has shifted.
We have oysters grow in December. That's kind of not normal. They're not growing much, but as it gets warmer, I think, if anything, the calendar shifted. If climate change is man-made, I would hope that man would be smart enough to stop doing what he's doing to have adverse effects.
At the end of June, a record heat wave had catastrophic effects for shellfish in the Pacific Northwest and Canada. Get used to it, scientists say. And the impacts will go beyond shellfish to marine life critical for tourism, says Michael Oppenheimer of the Intergovernmental Climate Change Panel.
And I've been to places where the health of the corals is clearly diminished, starting with South Florida, parts of the Mexican Yucatan, much of the Caribbean, certainly parts of the Pacific also.
What can be done? Back to our patch of seagrass. Levy Jewett is the director of the Ocean Acidification Program at NOAA.
If you can promote the growth of seagrasses, they might actually benefit and have been shown to benefit, for instance, corals that are growing around them. The real solution is to reduce emissions around the globe.
An enormous problem for global leaders. But it's not stopping Todd Janeski from taking small steps. Janeski, with the Virginia Commonwealth University, is part of a multilateral effort to restore oyster habitat by recycling their own shells.
Those larval oysters grow on that shell, and we put it onto restoration projects. We're seeing improvements in water clarity. We're seeing aquatic grasses nearby. By creating the habitat for oysters, what we have is a habitat for other animals as well.
Janeski has demonstrated the process to experts from Europe, Australia, and Asia. He says they are coming to recognize the value of oysters in the global fight against climate change. So the lowly oyster may not be so lowly after all. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Gloucester Point, Virginia.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.